Have you ever stopped to think about something as simple as, say, signing your name or reaching for a glass of water without even looking?
All the time. It's one of those things that feels completely automatic, but when you actually break it down, it's mind-bogglingly complex.
Exactly. And for me, that's where today's topic really hits home. As a kid, I was hopelessly clumsy. I mean, constantly tripping over my own feet. Learning that there's a specific part of the brain responsible for that grace, that physical poetry we see in athletes or dancers. Shinkia was a revelation.
Yeah, for me, it was learning to ride a bike. That feeling when it just clicks, you stop thinking, and your body just knows how to balance, how to pedal, how to steer. It's like there's a silent conductor in your head, coordinating everything behind the scenes.
A silent conductor. Or maybe a silent choreographer. It's not the part of the brain that decides what to do, but the part that dictates how to do it, with precision, with timing, with fluidity.
And what's truly exciting, and what we're going to get into, is that scientists are discovering this choreographer has a much wider repertoire than we ever imagined. It's not just about movement
That's
anymore.
the hook, isn't it? What happens when the master of motor control is also shaping our thoughts, our focus, maybe even our emotions?
It challenges everything we thought we knew. So today, we're pulling back the curtain on this incredible, often underestimated structure. We're going to explore the brain's silent choreographer. The cerebellum.
And that scale is just, I mean, it's almost impossible to comprehend. When you look at the actual cellular architecture, it's not just a conductor weighing a baton. It's more like a supercomputer processing an insane amount of data in parallel.
It really is. You have, and this number always gets me, as many as a billion parallel fibers, which are like the incoming data streams, all converging on a tiny group of cells. We're talking less than 50.
A billion to 50? That's an
Feasible.
unbelievable level of compression. How does anything meaningful even come out of that?
That's the magic, isn't it? It's all about fine-tuning. Each of those billion connections is adjustable. It's like having a sound mixing board with a billion sliders, and the cerebellum can tweak each one just a little bit to perfectly shape its output. It's not just on or off, it's about subtle adjustments.
So that's the how it performs the action. But what about getting better at it? That moment you described with the bike? That's a process. It's learning. Does that happen right there on that mixie board?
Ah, now you've hit on one of the biggest debates in the field. Does the learning happen in the cerebellum, or does the cerebellum just send out signals that tell other parts of the brain, hey, you need to learn this?
Okay, so it could be the teacher, or it could just be the one ringing the school bell.
Pretty much. But most of the evidence, especially from theorists like David Marr and James Albus back in the day, points to the cerebellum being the classroom and the teacher. They came up with this idea of a teaching signal.
A teaching signal. What does that look like? Is it a reward for doing something right?
That's what you'd think, right? That's what Marr originally thought. But the theory that's held up, Alvis's idea, is the complete opposite. The teaching signal is an error signal.
Wait, an error signal? So it only pipes up when you do something wrong?
Precisely. There's another type of input called a climbing fiber, and it seems to fire when there's a mismatch between what you intended to do and what you actually did. That firing acts as a signal to weaken the specific connections that just contributed to that mistake.
That is so counterintuitive. It's not learning by rewarding success, it's learning by pruning away failure.
It's chiseling the statue from the block of marble. It removes all the movements that aren't right until only the perfect fluid motion is left. And we've seen this in experiments. They had monkeys learning a reaching task, and when their performance was clumsy and poor, the climbing fibers were firing like crazy.
The error signals were flooding the system.
Exactly. But as the monkeys got better and their movements became more precise, the signals. They just quieted down. The teacher had nothing left to correct.
That's incredible. So the goal is silence. The sign of true mastery is when the brain's internal critic has nothing left to say. It just gets out of the way.
That seems to be the case. The system is so efficient, it doesn't waste energy sending signals that say, "Good job, you did it right." The absence of the error signal is the reward. It's the definition of automaticity.
That has such profound implications beyond just reaching for a glass. Think about a musician practicing a difficult passage. At first, it's all mistakes. The error signals must be a cacophony. But as they practice, it gets smoother, and that internal noise just fades out.
Right, and the muscle memory they talk about isn't just in the muscles, it's the quieting of that cerebellar teacher. It's a learned silence.
Okay, but this is where my mind goes next. If this incredibly powerful system for refining actions by pruning away errors exists, why would it only be used for movement, it seems like?
Mm-hmm.
Like a waste of a brilliant mechanism.
You've just walked through the door that has completely changed cerebellar research in the last 20 years. What if that same mechanism, that process of smoothing, refining, and automating is applied to things that aren't physical at all?
You mean like thoughts or emotions?
Precisely. Think about a thought as a kind of mental movement. Mm. You're moving from one concept to another. What if the cerebellum is running the same quality control check? It's looking for a mismatch between the thought you intended to have and the one that's actually forming.
Whoa. Okay, hang on. So a clumsy thought. A logical fallacy, maybe? Or a poorly formed argument in your own head that could trigger a cerebellar error signal?
That's the theory. It's not a clumsy reach with your arm. It's a clumsy reach for a conclusion. We see evidence for this in patients with cerebellar damage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that they have trouble walking a straight line. They have trouble with complex planning. Their cognitive sequencing is off. They might struggle to tell a coherent story, jumping back and forth in time.
Their mental grammar is broken.
That's a perfect way to put it. Their thoughts become dysmetric. That's the clinical term for when you overshoot or undershoot a physical target. They are cognitively dysmetric. They overshoot the point of an argument or can't quite get to the right word. It's like a mental stutter.
So a slip of the tongue might not just be a Freudian slip. It could be a cerebellar slip. The error correction failed for a split second.
It very well could be. The cerebellum isn't generating the word itself, that's the cortex, but it's ensuring the word that's selected is the right word for the context, delivered at the right time and speed. It's the difference between knowing the lines and having perfect comedic timing.
This is fascinating because we separate thinking and doing as two completely different things. But you're saying that on a fundamental structural level in the brain, the process for refining a tennis serve might be the exact same process for refining a sentence.
The hardware is the same. It's a universal error corrector. It takes a clumsy, rough output, whether that's from the motor cortex or the prefrontal cortex, and it smooths the edges until it's fluid and appropriate. It's the brain's ultimate quality control expert.
And that's the part that really changes everything. It's not just an editor for movement. It's a universal editor for any output the brain produces. It makes you wonder. That feeling of intuition, you know? When a sentence just feels right or an idea clicks into place. Is that the cerebellum giving a silent nod? The absence of an error signal?
That's a beautiful way to think about it. And it ties directly into this concept of forward models. The brain isn't just reacting, it's constantly predicting. When you reach for that glass, your cerebellum has already run a simulation. If I send these commands, my hand will end up here.
It predicts the sensory feedback.
Precisely. And that's the classic explanation for why you can't tickle yourself. The sensation is perfectly predicted, so it's not surprising. There's no error signal. The quality control expert already signed off on it.
Ah, that's brilliant. So a clumsy thought or a word that just hangs in the air wrong. It's like a cognitive tickle. It's a sensory surprise that your brain didn't anticipate, and the cerebellum flags it for correction.
Hmm.
That's the emerging picture. It's not just correcting the past. It's constantly running these micro-simulations of the immediate future to make our interactions with the world, both physical and mental, as smooth and seamless as possible.
It really does reframe so much. What it leaves me with one sort of lingering question. If this system is so fundamental to, well, to flow of thought and action, why has it been so underestimated for so long? We've always just seen it as the part of the brain that gets you through a field sobriety test.
That's a really important point. I think it's because the deficits are so much harder to see. A physical tremor is obvious, but a cognitive tremor, a dysmetria of thought, that's incredibly subtle. It gets chalked up to an off day, or it's me attributed to problems with higher level cortical areas.
Mm-hmm.
The symptoms are masked by other things.
Right. But now with this new understanding, researchers are looking at everything from learning disabilities to schizophrenia and autism through a cerebellar lens. They're asking if some of the core issues might be a fundamental problem with this predictive smoothing mechanism.
Wow. So as a final thought then, what's the biggest takeaway here? For me, it's that the wall we build between thinking and doing is completely artificial. The mechanism that refines a golf swing is the same one that refines an argument. It's all just movement.
I think that's perfectly put, and I'd just add that it changes our definition of mastery. We think mastery is about adding more knowledge, but this suggests mastery is about subtraction. It's about the gradual silencing of those internal error signals until all that's left is the pure intended action. The goal is a learned, effortless silence.
The silent choreographer finally gets to rest. A perfect place to end. Thank you for joining us on this journey into one of the brain's most fascinating and misunderstood structures.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next time.